While I do not believe I did anything illegal or ever thought I was doing anything illegal, I did an awful, awful lot that was wrong.
He said, "Hey, ain't you Jesse Harris?" And I couldn't deny that. I said, "Yeah."
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approved this message.
You know, the job we have as legislators is to decide where the lines are.
It is a very sacred and holy institution.
I said, "Well, I got a good job in Washington." He said, "What you doing up there?" I said, "Well, I got a job playing saxophone in a topless bar."
Members, the nurse of the day today is...
He said, "Well, that sure relieves my mind, because some fool told me you got elected to the United States Senate." And I knew that couldn't be so.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Legislative Press Dungeon in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. It's Tuesday, October 1st, 2019. Glad to have you along as always. Today, a conversation about Medicaid, and we turn our attention to a professor of health policy and management. Dr. Leighton Koo has been with the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University for some time now. Dr. Koo, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
You recently, earlier this year, finished a study, a 22-page report. It's titled "The Economic and Employment Benefits of Expanding Medicaid in North Carolina." So we're going to spend some of our time talking about that. We're going to also spend some of our time talking about why you were here today in Raleigh.
Great.
You're very much an advocate. You're an advocate for Medicaid expansion. You are also a policy analyst, a public health researcher and expert. You're going to be meeting on Tuesday morning with some lawmakers. You're going to be doing what has been described to me as a field hearing to make the case for Medicaid expansion. What is your message to those who will be in the audience?
Well, I want to step back for a moment. I will say I'm not here as an advocate. I'm not from North Carolina, so I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm here as someone who is a researcher to talk about what the evidence is. And I will say the evidence does lead me to the conclusion that expanding Medicaid would be a good thing for North Carolina. But again, you know, I don't vote here. I don't have any of those stakes. But the gist is that North Carolina is one of a minority of states left in the U.S. that has not expanded Medicaid. At this point, there are only 14 states left in the country that haven't done so. North Carolina has among the lowest eligibility levels in the country. It's around eighth from the bottom, which is pretty disappointing for a state that's doing as well as North Carolina is.
And let me pause real quick and just expound a little bit on that. When you say those are the eligibility requirements, those are the parameters through which someone can obtain Medicaid. And what we're talking about is a percentage above the federally determined poverty line.
That's right. And so what happens is that in North Carolina, if you are a parent whose income is above, say, $9,000 for a family of three, you make too much money to get health insurance through the state, through Medicaid. If you don't have children, if you're an adult who doesn't have any children, who are minors, it doesn't matter how poor you are not eligible for Medicaid. So North Carolina really is sort of an outlier there among the states. Now, what happens when this comes up as a subject? People who are concerned about it often say, you know, gee, I understand that people have some serious problems. On the other hand, if we expand Medicaid because our levels are so low now, it's going to bankrupt the state. And the gist of the message that I have of the analyses that we've done is that actually expanding Medicaid would be an economic boon for the state the way the law was set up. North Carolina would receive 90% of the federal funding would come from the federal government. So this would bring in around $12 billion over the next few years if North Carolina expanded Medicaid. That would help expand the economy in the state, increase the number of jobs, and so on.
So among the findings in this report I mentioned off the top, economic and employment benefits of expanding Medicaid in North Carolina. That's the formal title of it. We should, I guess, just pause and remind listeners that Medicaid is the federal health care program that, by and large, is for individuals living in poverty and people living with disabilities as well. You conducted this report for the Cohn Foundation.
That's right.
And among the top line findings that you came up with were that an estimated 634,000 low-income North Carolinians would get coverage by 2022 through expansion. Expanding Medicaid here would create a little bit more than 37,000 jobs. And as you lay it out, expansion would bring an additional, and you just mentioned this, $12 billion in funding to the state over the next 3 years. Numbers and radio numbers and podcasts don't always work particularly well, but those are the biggest numbers as I look through the report. What are a couple of the other major findings that you would want to make the case for?
So, you know, the real reason that you want to expand Medicaid is because there are a large number of people who are uninsured in North Carolina. And because they're uninsured, they have problems getting access to health care. And this pertains to people who have diabetes, people who have all sorts of problems. One of the things that's it's a huge issue in North Carolina, it's a huge issue in lots of states, is opioid addiction. So, you know, in addition to the economic aspects of it, a big point is that by expanding Medicaid, we can help get a large number of people into care and help make that more affordable. So, for example, if you have someone who has an opioid addiction, it can help get them the medications, help get them treatment, so they can try to kick that habit.
This field hearing that takes place on Tuesday, I imagine there will be a healthy number of Democrats in the room. Democrats, by and large, support Medicaid expansion. There's certainly much more of a divide when we think about at least the conservatives that work in this building, the North Carolina legislature. Some Republicans have long been vehemently opposed to expanding Medicaid. I'm wondering what Republican lawmakers, if any, you have scheduled meetings with or you're going to try to bend the ear of while you're here in Raleigh.
I don't know. You know, I'm coming to this hearing at the invitation. I must admit, I don't know what Republican legislators will or will not be there. Again, I'm not going to lobby anybody. You know, that's not what my role is. So I'm not exactly sure. I certainly hope that some Republican legislators would be in there. I'd be happy to talk with them and to explain at least my perspective on it, and I understand that there's a strong partisan divide, and there may be some misunderstanding. I mean, I can't change people's fundamental political position, and that's not my role, but to the extent that I can sort of explain where there might be some misunderstandings, I'm happy to do that.
So your analysis looks at clean Medicaid expansion, or Medicaid expansion that would not have work requirements or premiums. This bill, 655 in the House, House Bill 655, sponsored by Donnie Lambeth, a Republican from Forsyth County, has just those two things. It has work requirements and it has premiums. It is effectively Medicaid light. But I'm wondering how those provisions would affect your projections for dollars coming in, for jobs, for the number of people who would gain access to health care.
Sure. We didn't do an analysis of that bill. Partly it was that I never found any sort of fiscal analysis that had been done in North Carolina of that bill that we could sort of do our work based on, whereas with the governor's proposal, which was the straight Medicaid expansion, we had some estimates that we could begin to do some analysis with. In general, what I'd expect is if you have a Medicaid expansion that's coupled with work requirements. And what I mean by work requirements is there'd be a requirement that if North Carolina did it like other states, the state would say certain adults, if they're going to get Medicaid, have to work at least, say, 20 hours a month. And if they don't do that for several months, then basically they lose their Medicaid. And in addition to this, would charge premiums so that people who have a certain income level would have to pay some number of dollars per month to get Medicaid. What that'll do is that'll lower the number of people who get Medicaid. There's no question about that. We know that from other states. It'll still be something of an expansion. So what would happen is that it would still bring in some economic benefits for the state. It would still expand health insurance coverage, and so maybe it's not 600 some thousand, maybe it's 200,000, 300,000. I don't know the number because I haven't seen a good analysis, but so it would still do some good. There are a couple of problems with it. One is it wouldn't do as much good. The other that's the big hanging question is we don't know whether work requirements are legal. This has been challenged in a number of states. There are four lawsuits that have gone on, three that have gone to a decision by a judge. And in every case, the judge has said, this isn't legal. So this is one of these things where states are trying to do something that may not be legal, in which case it's not clear how it all works out.
With the exception of Indiana, is Indiana the one place that presently has work requirements on the books?
There are a few other states that have work requirements on the books. They haven't kicked people off the program yet. And Indiana, a lawsuit was just brought.
Okay.
So we would expect it to go to court sometime before too long. So Indiana is the fourth state that has now, there's a lawsuit, hasn't gone to a hearing yet. But in the other states, so this is Kentucky, which is right nearby New Hampshire, and oh my gosh, I've forgotten who the third state is. It's blanked my mind.
Not New Orleans, Arkansas.
Arkansas, West Virginia, and New Hampshire. In every single case, the federal courts have said that this is not legal. So, you know, there are some significant doubts about it. And I say doubts because though a judge has said it's not legal, these things will get appealed and they may drag on for years and years and years in court. So I won't say the door is closed on that option.
A couple of questions I wanted to get to with you. One, I think kind of looking back, the other looking forward as it pertains to Medicaid expansion. The one looking back deals with the reimbursement rates. And as you just reminded folks, and I think as people know who have been following the Medicaid conversation, if North Carolina were to expand, the reimbursement would be a 90-10 split, at least for the time being. And opponents will tell you that that could change, but we know for certain right now that it's a 90-10 split, where the federal government picks up 90% of the Medicaid bill.
Right.
Currently, because North Carolina is one of those 14 states that did not expand, it's roughly a 67-33 split.
That's
meaning
right.
That North Carolina is paying 33% of the Medicaid bill as opposed to as opposed to 10%. By your estimation or calculation, how much in reimbursement has the state left on the table by choosing not to expand Medicaid?
Well, so it's left billions of dollars on the table. It's between the range of, you know, it could have begun to expand on January 2014. It's left on the table about $3 to $4 billion in federal matching funds every single year since then. But an additional thing, there was a calculation that someone asked about, I just did recently, that basically said, well, how much are North Carolinians paying in federal taxes to expand Medicaid in other states? So right now, because Medicaid has expanded in 37 states around the country, federal taxpayers are paying that 90% for the expansions that went on in states other than North Carolina. And when I try to do the calculation, it looks as though North Carolina taxpayers have already spent more than $8 billion paying for Medicaid expansions in other states. So that may be another reason to think about this. Here, this is money that's been flowing out of North Carolina. Here's an opportunity to bring some of those funds back into the state where they can help do things like pay for health care, pay for hospitals. I know one of the issues that's been going on in North Carolina, a lot of other states, is some rural hospitals are in real financial trouble. It'll help support that. It'll help support primary care so people can, again, do things like get their medications for high blood pressure, for diabetes, so it can do a lot of good.
36 states have expanded. Also, the District of Columbia, where you work, you're a professor, long-time professor at George Washington University, Dr. Leighton Koo, here on the Politics Podcast, chatting about Medicaid expansion. I mentioned a question back. I also wanted to ask you, thinking about the future, if Medicaid were ever to be expanded here, I wonder about reimbursement rates. And I am not a healthcare reporter. I never have been. But in some of the healthcare reporting that I have done on a story-by-story basis, you hear from family practitioners, sometimes you'll hear from specialists who talk about the reimbursement rates with Medicaid, and they say that they're so low that it's just financially it's a loser for them. Financially, it's a loss. Now, you can make a moral argument. You can make the argument of people need health care. But in terms of doctors who are losing money because the reimbursement rates with Medicaid are so low, how can that be improved upon? How can that be dealt with? What can be done so that in large areas of this state where there are not a lot of specialists of certain varieties, how do you overcome that hurdle?
Well, that's a good question. And part of it is if the federal government pays a larger share, then it makes it less expensive for the state to raise rates to hospitals or to doctors or for whatever. Now, I don't know exactly how the pay rates are in North Carolina. I understand that in many areas they say they're not sufficient. But the bottom line is that we do know that when Medicaid has been expanded in other states, more people are able to get health care one way or the other. So I don't entirely agree with doctors or hospitals that say they're losing money, because what will happen is Medicaid may pay lower rates than private insurance might pay. On the other hand, if they're already open, if they're already have their nurses hired to serve, you know, an additional 1 to 10 people, does not cost a whole lot of money. And basically, it helps more people. But I understand why some of them say that they don't think it pays the rates they'd like. I don't know that any of us think that we're paid exactly what we'd like to be paid. So I get it, and no one will force them to go take Medicaid.
So as we think about a gap or an area that might be underserved, if there's a multi-county area in the coastal plains and the eastern part of the state that doesn't have a lot of OBGYNs or doesn't have a lot of orthopedic surgeons, or, I mean, you pick whatever area of medicine you want. Is it realistic to think let me ask it this way. How is expanding Medicaid going to help with what I'll classify as doctor deserts?
Sure. I think of it this way. It's part of the reason there are doctor deserts in part of the state, particularly in places where there are large pockets of uninsured people, is essentially speaking, they're not enough paying customers. It's the situation of you think, where am I going to situate a new store, whether it's a pizza shop, whether it's a Walmart? What you want to do is you want to find areas where they're paying customers. If you expand Medicaid, you will increase the number of people who are paying customers. You will therefore make it more attractive, more able for a doctor or a hospital or for a clinic to keep its practice open because of that. So that's certainly what we've seen in other states. It's helped out with some of those shortages. Again, you know, certainly the most dire case that people hear a lot about are rural hospitals. If you look at the states that have expanded Medicaid, the states that have not expanded Medicaid, it's these states largely in the Southeast that have not expanded Medicaid. That's where all the rural hospital closures have been occurring. So it helps maintain a healthcare safety net system. It's not going to do everything possible. There needs to be adequate support by the state. There need to be other facilities and doing other things that help increase the number of people who can pay for health care by having insurance. That's ultimately the thing that helps attract it. Now, some people, I will acknowledge, if you've been trained in a big city and suddenly you're asked to go practice in an area that there's no movie theaters, there's, you know, nothing to do, it's going to be less attractive for some people. On the other hand, you can try to find doctors, nurses who are willing to go out in these areas because they like the country, because they grew up there. So that's another long-term issue for the state, is how we can find people to do these things. Now, actually, I just recently did a study. One of the big shortages that occurs actually is dental care. Mm-hmm. We just recently completed a study that actually shows dentists who are in rural areas are more likely to accept Medicaid patients than dentists who are in urban areas. And I think it's that they feel a greater obligation to provide care to whoever it is that's in their community. And in addition, they need to have just more patients coming through the door.
Do you think it's as simple as that, of allowing the markets to take care of themselves, and that if they're paying customers, you're going to attract doctors, potential high earners, to areas that, as you say, might not have a lot of the cultural benefits or incentives that a lot of urban and suburban communities have.
I'm not saying that's going to do all of it. I'm saying that's part of the solution. There are a variety of ways in which both the federal and state governments and local areas try to help encourage people to come to areas. Some of it is there's the Community Health Center program, in which the federal government helps set up nonprofit clinics in areas that are underserved. There's a program called the National Health Service Corps, which basically tells doctors and dentists and mental health care providers, if you're willing to go practice in one of these underserved areas, we'll repay your educational loans. So we'll cover some of those costs. Oftentimes, local communities will kick in some incentives, too.
You mentioned opioids earlier. That's certainly a major health problem, a crisis in this country. There's also gun violence. And I think those have certainly taken on something of a political backdrop. Not to say they aren't important, but we've seen and heard a little bit more about those in politics, from my perspective, in the last year or two. But we also have major health crises. When we think about diabetes, when we think about obesity, mental health and suicide to a degree. But thinking about diabetes and obesity, I guess specifically for a moment, you mentioned the American South. You mentioned that most of the states that did not expand Medicaid are here in the southeastern United States. And acknowledging, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so please push back, but acknowledging that Medicaid is not some silver bullet to solve the health problems in our country. Stepping away from Medicaid for a moment, I'm curious if your research has pointed toward remedies or things that you think would be other impactful, important steps in curbing some of these major public health crises, whether it's your research or legislation or proposals that you've seen in other southeastern states.
Sure. And by the way, I'll correct you.
Please do.
You said at the beginning, you said I was at the public policy school in George Washington University. Actually, I'm in the public health school.
Okay.
So my school is filled with colleagues and experts who are addressing just these sorts of problems. So, for example, we have a Department of Exercise and Nutrition Sciences. And, you know, that's one of the goals for diabetes and obesity is can we help people change their diets, increase their level of physical activity, and, you know, walking through the street, it's not all that hot yet in the morning, but I do realize it's going to get pretty warm here soon. And I grew up in San Antonio, Texas, where it's even hotter than Raleigh, North Carolina. I understand how that sort of discourages people from doing things like exercise. But it's important, and those are part of the ways that we can do things to help encourage those activities. But certainly medical care helps. That's where if you go to a doctor, the doctor sort of urging you, maybe helping you make a connection to a nutritionist who can give you some advice. If you have diabetes, putting you on the medications that can take care of it. If you're really, as they say, morbidly obese, that's the phrase. That means when you're over really, really heavy. There's bariatric surgery, which is a new kind of surgery that basically shrinks your stomach. The results have been phenomenal of the reversals of diabetes when people sort of lose large amounts of weight due to bariatric surgery. This is really one of the modern miracles that's happened just within the past decade. I'll mention the other thing that's important, and it's particularly important to say like North Carolina, is tobacco. Smoking is still the number one killer of people in the U.S., we're lucky it's been declining for a number of years in general. On the other hand, the people who are on Medicaid still smoke more often than people who are the general middle class population. It's sort of turned into a class-oriented problem. That's one of the things that Medicaid can also do is it can help people get into tobacco cessation programs so they can get the counseling, that they can get the medications that'll help them ease that problem and add years to their life.
What else have we not covered that you want to make sure we address, if anything?
Well, I think, you know, part of the issue that comes up is really the sort of fairly sad partisan divide that existed regarding Medicaid expansion. And it's unfortunate that the states that have in many cases been unwilling to sort of expand Medicaid are often states that have larger populations who are poor, definitely have larger populations who are uninsured. You know, and I think that was part of the point when the Affordable Care Act was passed a number of years ago, was to try to help make that less uneven across the country, to help equalize the country. So that, to me, is sort of from a big picture perspective, one of the things that's sad about the fact that so many states like North Carolina still haven't expanded Medicaid, and it has been changing. So there are neighbors to North Carolina, there are states that are not that far away, like Kentucky, like West Virginia, like Virginia, that have expanded Medicaid. So we've seen when those states expand Medicaid, there are dramatic, and I really mean dramatic, reductions in the number of people who are uninsured. So it's something that can help a lot, has helped in other areas. Again, I am not from North Carolina, so I'm not going to tell anyone here in North Carolina how to vote. But there are some reasons that improve the health, that can improve the economy, that can mean it that there are a few more jobs in every part of the state. I will say it's maybe worth explaining why that happens. So again, when Medicaid expands, the federal government will pay 90% of that cost. So there are billions of dollars, I'd estimate around $12 billion, that would flow into North Carolina over the next 3 years if we expanded Medicaid here. Because of that, first that money is going to go into healthcare. So first that'll go to hospitals and doctors' offices and pharmacies. But what they do is they employ people. And then what those people do is they are consumers. So they will then go out and buy groceries, pay their rent, do all the things that normal consumers do. And so in the end, it helps pick up the economy a little to sort of help bolster it. And it happens in every corner of the state. So it really is the kind of thing that can have broad benefits. In the end, it'll help increase state tax collections, local tax collections, and not because the tax rate's going to go a penny, but simply because there's a little more income in the state.
The tax base is increasing.
The tax base will expand. Right. Exactly so. So that's why there are those economic benefits in addition to the health care benefits.
You are data-driven, obviously, in the research that you do. Roughly a million North Carolinians without health coverage, uninsured, right, from the healthcare perspective. If you were to have 10 minutes with Senator Berger or Speaker Moore, Phil Berger, Tim Moore, the two most powerful politicians in certainly in the legislature, if not North Carolina politics, you'd make a data-driven argument. But what else would you say to them?
Well, I'd like to understand. I must admit, and once again, I'm a data person, so that's certainly what my forte is. But I'd like to start out by understanding what their concerns are. Are there ways that they feel that that can be made in a fashion that's appropriate for North Carolina? That's certainly some of the things that I think sometimes I hear state legislators are concerned about. They think the federal government is forcing this down our throats and we want to do things our way. And so obviously the federal government has not forced it down anyone's throat yet. But to the extent that there are things that can be done that make legislators feel that this is something that will reflect North Carolina values and help support the healthcare system and the population in North Carolina, I'd love to hear their thoughts. I'm not a decision maker here, so I'm not going to make those policies. But I'm a researcher. I'm curious.
Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University, Dr. Leighton Koo. Doctor, thank you for the conversation.
Enjoy talking with you.
As always, thanks for downloading and listening to the WUNC Politics Podcast. Stay up to date later in the week with what's happening in North Carolina politics as we turn to Rob Schofield and Becky Gray for analysis and conversation of whatever hit your news feed in the previous days. Of course, you can always find the latest news at our website as well, wunc.org. For Dr. Koo, I'm Jeff Tiberi. We'll talk to you again soon.